Now, your host for Public Pulse, Floyd Whitey.
Good morning. It is Monday, November 18th, and from Wyoming's Emerald City, I'm Floyd Whiting, and this is Public Pulse. This morning, I am joined by Sheridan Memorial Hospital Addiction and Internal Medicine Clinic Doctor, Jason Ackerman. Good morning, Doc, and welcome back. Now, when we look at the fall season, and after the Elk Fire, and a really tough summer, how's it going for you?
It's good. Our clinic has been busy, which I guess is kind of good and bad when you're have an addiction medicine clinic. So,
and we get to this time of year, which we'll get into a little bit. It always gets a little rougher for some folks, doesn't it?
It does. And right about now is kind of when we start having those check-ins with everybody and, you know, how are the holidays going to be for you? And for some people, you know, the holidays are great and it's a supportive time. It's festive. It's fun. For a lot of my patients, the holidays tend to bring a little bit more trouble, pain. Yeah. Some of the cravings go up. So it can be a little bit rougher.
Yeah. It's tough to think about. Now, for those who don't know you, where'd you grow up?
I actually grew up here. So I graduated high school from here and then went away for college and wasn't sure I would ever come back and was very excited to come back. It's been over 10 years now.
That's incredible. What led you to the career choice of being a doctor? I talk to a lot of folks who have almost like a very pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. Someone was, really impacted them. What was it for you?
So for me, actually, it's interesting. My younger brother had a pediatric cancer and dealt with that for a really long time. And just the folks that we were around down at Denver Children's were amazing and just kind of the impact that they had. And so it actually took a while for me to get there. I did economic consulting and stuff for a while, but it just didn't satisfy. It wasn't right. And so ended up going back to school and back to med school for that. And really thought I would do pediatric oncology. Very glad I ended up in the field I did, though.
Really? What changed you from pediatric over to addiction?
So I went into internal medicine mostly because I really liked the complex adult medicine and kind of solving the puzzles. But as part of that, so after med school, you do a 3-year residency and training in internal medicine. And we went to Yale my wife and I went to Yale for our internal medicine residency, and that happens to be where they have a lot of addiction doctors and kind of doing a lot of the research and some of the more cutting edge stuff. And those people were just the most amazing people. And I think part of what really draws me to addiction medicine is internal medicine is great. I love it. I love everything about it. But at the end of the day, a lot of times we're treating numbers. We're trying to get somebody's cholesterol a little bit better, or you're trying to get a blood pressure a little bit lower to reduce the risk of something bad happening down the road. Addiction medicine is maybe a little bit, you can feel the impact more. And so, you know, we can get these people in their 20s and pretty soon they're no longer homeless and they have a place to live and they get their kids back. And, you know, some of them are going to Sheridan College and all of a sudden, like, you're giving somebody their entire life back rather than just treating numbers. And it's just, I don't know. I think it's a really rewarding field. It's very, very fun.
And I would echo that completely. In the throes of addiction, it affects every aspect of your life, professional, personal, family. The walls come tumbling down. And then, although it takes time and a lot of work, once you're back up on your feet, the phrase breath of fresh air doesn't even come close. It's something completely different, which, you know, is why we put so much emphasis mm-hmm. upon it. Because recovery is a long road, but as you begin to walk it and you put a little bit of that road under your feet, it just gets better and better.
Absolutely. And it is amazing to see people kind of starting to walk that road and just and really reinvent themselves. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, substance use, whatever their substance of choice, starts early. You mm-hmm. know, it starts, you know, sometimes shockingly early. I talk to my patients and I'm always amazed at how early it started. But for a lot of people, it's teens, it's early adult years. And so people really have to reinvent themselves and learn even basic coping skills, basic adulting skills, and watching them do that. And it's just, it's amazing. It's really, really fun.
And Mine was 15 years old.
Yeah.
Even though the drinking wasn't as severe, that's where the binge drinking really started. You know, you might not drink every day, but when you do, oh, it's a bottle.
Right.
And you know, when you're a kid, you don't know any better, and you kind of keep that bottle as like a symbol of pride almost.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I drank this, you know.
And, yeah.
And then all of a sudden, looking back on that, I just shake my head, that time in my life. But now we've talked about what inspired you to go into addiction medicine. Can you tell me a little bit about the addiction and internal medicine clinic that you run?
Yeah. So really our focus is addiction medicine. And so, originally I was boarded in internal medicine in 2019. I believe I got boarded also in addiction medicine, and that became kind of a bigger and bigger part of my practice until now. That's really our focus. And so we work with patients with addictions or substance use issues, with really any substance, you know, alcohol and opioids, stimulants. We also take care of people with gambling problems, and just kind of runs the gamut of addiction. For those folks, we also, you know, offer the full primary care. Right now we're offering a lot of the mental health medication and psychiatric care as well. It's going to be really exciting. We have a new psychiatrist joining us at Sherrod Memorial Hospital. So that's going to be a really big help for our clinic.
When we look at the word addiction, mm-hmm. there's almost a shadow over top of this word. It hides what it actually is. A lot of people don't sit down and discuss this at dinner. If addiction has affected our lives, there's such a stigma that surrounds it that we tend to kind of hide it within the family. We don't want to talk about it. What is addiction?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I think we've really stigmatized that word, and I think that can be part of the problem, and that can really be part of the, you know, some of the difficulty with patients reaching out and trying to seek help. Addiction really comes down to that loss of control. And so, you know, if we look at certain criteria, diagnostic criteria, all of it kind of centers around, you know, patients using a substance or gambling, like, you know, doing an activity more than they really intended, and then only being able to function well while they're doing that. And people truly become dependent on that. But again, there's that loss of control aspect of it, I think, that is really the hallmark of addiction versus just kind of misuse.
Recreational, I guess we could say.
Exactly. And, you know, even we try to be as specific as we can in medicine, and diagnoses are really, really important for us. And so we've tried to shift a lot of our language. You know, patients still talk about it as addiction, but we try to, at least as we're discussing it, talk about it more as a substance use disorder. And some of that gets back to the stigma, and some of it gets back to really our understanding of this. So we used to think of addiction, and a lot of people still think of addiction, as just a series of bad choices that people have made. And, you know, they kind of look at it as, well, stop making those bad choices and things will just get better. Our understanding of addiction as a true disease process, and understanding what parts of the brain are affected and how substances interact with different parts of the brain, we've really come a long way with our understanding of that. And one of the nice parts about being able to treat this as the medical disorder that it is it also means that there's treatments that we can do. And so I think that offers a lot of hope for people, but there's still that stigma of addiction. It still gets very, very hard. You know, I always thank people for coming into the clinic, because just making that first phone call and walking in that door that first time is really scary.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A lot of people say, you know, acceptance is the first step. When I was 24, I was drunk enough to have a conversation with my father. And my father and I don't talk about these kinds of things very often. But he told me that was one of the worst parts about me. He said, you've already accepted it, and you just don't care. And that's what made it rough. Because he knew I'd taken that first step, but he was very afraid I would never take the second. And it was very, very true. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I had this dependency. And when it comes to dependencies, it's easy to look, not easy, but it's more common to look at dependencies upon a substance or alcohol. But when we look at behaviors, when we look at gambling addictions, pornography addictions, addictions to video games, all of these things release a dopamine that these individuals become addicted to, correct?
Correct.
So that is why, like, a behavior can also become an addiction.
Correct.
Now, the dopamine, for those who may not know what dopamine is in the brain, what is this?
So dopamine does a lot of things for us. It's traditionally what we think of as the reward chemical. So when something good happens, the brain releases dopamine. So when you take a bite of that chocolate bar, you get dopamine. It feels good, and we want to do it again. For patients with substance use disorders, that alcohol, you know, triggers that dopamine release, and it feels good, and we want to do it again. Dopamine also tends to be our motivation molecule as well. So it's what really gets us off the couch and gets us moving and gets us doing something. And so different substances can cause dopamine release just by using them. So alcohol, we get that dopamine rush, and eventually we keep doing that and kind of reinforces that behavior, which in turn kind of rewires the brain. Some substances like methamphetamine actually triggers a big dopamine release and prevents our body from reabsorbing the dopamine. And so we kind of burn out our stores. And so then that becomes a whole nother problem when people are trying to stop stimulants, for example, is we don't have any dopamine stores left.
And it's so almost like they don't get the reward anymore.
They don't get the reward, but they also have terrible energy levels when they stop using because they've burned out their dopamine supply, and it takes a long time for your body to rebuild that. And so again, we talk about repetitive behaviors. It's almost impossible for them not to use. You know, if you look, it takes 8 weeks to get back to a normal sort of motivation level. And you know, the one thing that can get you motivated and get you off the couch in a hurry, it gets really, really hard to kind of buy that clean time and get a little bit of traction there.
Wow. Hey, so far behind. Yeah, having to go 8 weeks without any kind of shot to the brain telling you you're doing a great job, you're mm-hmm. doing okay. You know, pats on the back are great. Words of encouragement are needed. But you also need that internal, I'm doing well. I'm that internal hope. And for those stimulants and methamphetamine addicts, I've always felt so horrible for them because they don't get that for the longest period of time. In a period that I feel we desperately need it. And so that is why it is so hard to kick that stuff. What trends have you seen while working in the clinic? Do you get kind of rushes? And in that, do you kind of see, well, where's all this addiction coming from? Where's that coming from? Why am I seeing so many of these patients? Do you see that up there?
I think we get a little bit more of kind of what you alluded to at the beginning. We kind of get seasonal problems where people kind of get overwhelmed by seasonal things. And so certainly the holidays are, you know, a very classic time for people to struggle. As far as trends go, I think we've mirrored the national trends. We've just been a little bit slow. So alcohol has kind of always been a problem. Methamphetamine has been a problem, and is that's increasing. We were actually really sheltered for quite a while, and we didn't have the same degree of fentanyl problems that a lot of the country had. And so fentanyl was a little slower to get here. It's definitely here. So patients struggling with opioids, like, we're seeing a lot more of the fentanyl, and that's much more difficult to treat than traditional opioids. And so I think we tend to mirror the national trends. For whatever reason, good or bad, we just tend to be a little bit slower to get there.
Well, I can remember being a kid. And took forever to get certain movies here. So
right.
I totally understand.
Similar.
A little similar, yeah. Now, have you seen an increase in need within the community for this kind of care? And if so, why do you think that is?
I think it's hard to say if it's an increase in need or it's just becoming more known that it's an option. And I think... When you look at addiction trends across time, just based on genetics, based on society, like we have about a background rate of about 9% addiction, and that kind of crosses socioeconomic groups, it crosses racial groups. It really, a lot of that is kind of founded in genetics. And so, you know, at any given time, you can estimate there's about 10% of the people that are struggling with a substance use disorder. I think as we're hopefully doing a better job destigmatizing this and people are realizing that there are options, we're seeing that increase in demand to come to our clinic. And I think hopefully it's just a matter of we're making this more available and just letting people know that that's an option.
Yeah. And in allowing people to know that, I often wonder if the entire stigma of addiction was broken down within our society, if more people would come forward, if the shame is what's keeping them from taking those first initial steps. And I know there's got to be a percentage of them. How do you feel about that?
I think there's a huge percentage of that, you know, and I think again, just because this is kind of how we've always been raised and this has kind of been the prevalent thinking is, you know, if you're struggling with something, it's because you've made bad decisions or something wrong with you. And that's kind of a hard thing to cope with for people. You know, again, we know genetics, just with the genes that we've identified, account for about 60% of somebody's risk for developing a substance use disorder. So over half of the risk is just genes. If we stigmatize diabetes the same way, people wouldn't come in for insulin. They wouldn't come in to get their labs done and to try to get back on track. We've made it really, really hard, and we've put all of these hurdles in front of people and just made it that much more difficult for people to kind of accept medical help for this.
Agreed. On that, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We're going to have more with addiction and internal medicine clinic doctor Jason Ackerman right after this. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM, Sheridan. And welcome back to Public Pulse. I'm your host, Floyd Whiting. This morning, we're speaking with Sheridan Memorial Hospital addiction and internal medicine clinic doctor, Jason Ackerman. Now, before we took a break, we were speaking on the need within the Sheridan community for addiction medicine. What is a social determinant when we talk about that in regards to our health?
So that really encompasses kind of almost everything outside of genetics. And so we know that people that are you know, economically disadvantaged, don't necessarily have food security, don't have access to food. You know, we know that those patients have worse health outcomes. And that really applies to across the board to nearly every disease process, is really, really applicable in the setting of addiction. So we know that socioeconomics plays a big role. And there's always that question of nature versus nurture.
Yeah,
you know, but I do think that we see a lot of patients whose families have struggled with addiction, and as they have grown up, like that's kind of how they see parents coping. That's how they see family members coping, and that becomes their internalized coping skill.
That's the norm.
It's the norm, and so we definitely see some of those the socioeconomics play a huge role in just. At what age do people develop substance use disorders?
And I think that was kind of what we were talking about, even just in the first part. You know, I was young and you know, I was living in Baker City, 15 years old, already kind of on my own. And drinking with the guys was just what you did after work. It's what you did during your weekend when you weren't at work. And that it was a normal thing. Like looking back on it, never once did I think to myself, this could lead to something later on. No, this was just the way life was. And this is how we celebrate. This is how we mourn. This is how we live.
Right.
Like that. How can social determinants of health contribute to an individual's risk of addiction or substance abuse? Is that just the socioeconomics?
It's certainly not just the socioeconomics. And again, we know that genetics plays a huge role in that. And, you know, we know that you can't undo your genetics. Like, you know, you're born with them. That's what you're kind of stuck with. Of the things that we have generally found that really can impact long-term addiction trends, especially in patients that have those genes or come from those backgrounds, education, honestly, is like the one thing that we've found that can really start heading off some of those addiction issues and substance use issues. And so education really becomes important, encouraging kids to, you know, stick with school and the farther that we can go. And you know, certainly I think some of that is just the process of education, you know, like what you learn, but also there's that training people. This is how you be a functional adult in society. Yeah. And learning all of those kind of coping skills as we go along. So education becomes really, really important in terms of heading some of that off. There's other much bigger issues that are kind of harder to tackle. You know, we know that poverty plays a big role in addiction. And again, sometimes that easy way out, that easy coping mechanism certainly becomes an issue. That's probably a bigger question than I'm able to answer.
I think if we were able to answer it, we'd be rich men or major contributors to kind of putting a doorstop in all of this.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk about this time of year and the trends that you see up at the hospital. I think everybody knows, everyone who's listening understands at least a little bit the stress of the holiday season, from gifts to family, you know, I think a lot of us out there just got to, you know, we're good right there.
Right.
There's a lot of stress factors right now on people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, especially when we talk about alcohol, you know, we see you mentioned earlier kind of the ties with celebrations. And I think that's kind of been really ingrained in us culturally is, you know, we celebrate with champagne or beer and there's, you know, wine at all of the Thanksgiving dinners. And so I think for a lot of people, there is certainly a lot of stress that goes along with the holidays and that leads to reaching for that easy coping mechanism. I think it becomes that much harder when you do also attend family gatherings and, you know, kind of the unstated expectation is that everybody is going to have a little bit of alcohol to celebrate. And if you don't, then you're really not fitting in socially or
the odd one out.
Yeah. And I think the reality is, I think most family members would be really not offended if somebody skipped out on that beer, on that glass of wine. And I think the pressure to drink or the pressure to use substances in those family gatherings, some of it's real and some of it is probably a little bit projected by the patients with substance use disorders. But from their perspective, that is extremely real. And so going to even just a Thanksgiving dinner and trying to figure out, you know, what can I do to avoid having that glass of wine is extraordinarily stressful for them. And so it's just that stress, that holiday stress just kind of creeps in almost every facet. And it's a difficult time for a lot of patients.
And I can echo that exact thing. And there was something that you touched on there where it may be more internalized than reality. When I first laid it down, I was still very much hanging out with like a lot of the guys that I deployed with. I mean, they were a fantastic support system for me. But then they would be joined by others who didn't. No, you know, and we're all going to do a cheers, you know, so, well, why isn't that guy holding a glass? What's that guy's issue? Now, you know, when everyone else is partaking and you're not, there is this sudden flush of the face where you're like, okay, who's going to ask? Are they going to want to get into details? Are they going to want an explanation? And these pressures start to kind of fold around you, even though they may not have given you a second thought. Oh, he just doesn't drink. Okay, well, I'm moving on. But internally, you're grabbing a hold of that, putting pressure on yourself. And that can be very, very tough.
And I think sometimes people don't really know what situation they're walking into as well. I mean, I think you can have that, you know, internalized pressure that doesn't actually exist. At the same time, I had a patient fairly recently that went to an uncle's memorial service and his uncle died of alcohol-related complications, died of liver failure. My patient has been doing great for 6 months, and all of the family was really, really pressuring him, you know, like uncle would have wanted us to drink, and mm-hmm. and he had a really hard time and eventually had to leave. And so again, I think some of that comes back to kind of like that nature versus nurture. Like, this is ingrained in our family structure. This is how we celebrate. This is how we mourn. And even with that recognition that he had been struggling and now is healthy and doing really well, there was still that pressure, you know, just one.
Yeah.
Know,
just one. And boy, you know how many times I've heard that?
Yeah.
Just one. But that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's always just the one. And when I first walked into AA, there was an older woman sitting there who looked very, very sad. And I had come early. It was my first time, so I wanted to be early. And she asked me if it was my first time. And I said, yeah, and asked her the same thing. And she said, no, I'm coming back after 22 years of being sober. I had one, and it led to a 2-week drinking binge. So one was all it took. And I think if everybody understood that and why that takes place, I think it would be a little bit easier, because there is no such thing as just one. How do you help your patients and their families succeed in maintaining this sobriety through these types of challenges like this? Do you try to bring everybody in? Do you try to bring in core individuals? How do you help them?
Well, I think that kind of gets back to, you know, what can we do with medications to help people? And so, you know, we understand that that this is a really, really difficult disease. And, you know, we talked about just kind of taking those first steps through the door is really difficult. The way I kind of discuss medications with my patients is, you know, I don't have a medication that's going to knock the bottle out of your hand. You know, everything that we do is just really trying to tip the odds in your favor. And so that motivation still really has to come from the patient. Certainly everything we can do to help them be successful, you know, medications can reduce the cravings. They can reduce the risk that you're going to have that first drink, or that if you do have that drink, the less risk that drink becomes 5, or that one day becomes a week. And so we're really kind of playing the odds there. I think that the people that are really successful, though, kind of incorporate, like you were talking about, support systems. They incorporate family. They incorporate other interests. They find other things to do. They have the medication, and they have the support systems, and they have the outside interests, and they have that the why that's driving them. Why am I putting in all of this work to get sober and stay sober? And so one of the things that we really try to ask patients at the, you know, is even at the beginning and as we're going along, is what is your support system? Like, who is your person? Who are your people that you're going to call when you start to struggle? Because medications can help, but they can only do so much. And at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday, when you're really, really struggling, what's your go-to? What's your coping mechanism? Like, who are your people? And I think that's really doubly important around the holidays.
Absolutely. And, you know, it gets easier, but it's not easy. And I think that's one thing that also needs acceptance right out of the gate. This is going to be a lifelong struggle. One must imagine Sisyphus happy, pushing the ball, you know, the large rock up the hill forever. But that you can find joy even in that. You know, and that's what it takes, is to find a new joy for you, and having that system where you can call on someone if it just gets to be too much, and that person can offer you even the slightest words of encouragement can refill your dopamine, refill right. your cup, you know, reassure you that you're going in the right direction. And it's going to be a hard struggle for a long time. But it does get easier as you go. On that, I've got to take another quick commercial break. We're going to have more with Addiction and Internal Medicine Clinic Dr. Jason Ackerman when we return. You're listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM, Sheridan. Good morning. Welcome back to Public Pulse, proudly brought to you by our friends out there at First Federal Bank and Trust. I'm Floyd Wining, and this morning we're speaking with Sheridan Memorial Hospital Addiction and Internal Medicine Clinic Doctor Jason Ackerman. We're speaking on addiction, gauging success within our recoveries. It's so tough. Even offline right here, we were having the discussion, the bridges that we burn. Do you often have family members approach you, Doc, saying, you know, how do I help so-and-so? What can I do to help them through this?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, we get a lot of calls in our clinic. We get family members coming in with patients. And I think it's, you know, when somebody is ready to actually start getting better, when somebody is ready to kind of start going through that recovery process, I think it's crucial for them to have that support. And maybe that's family, maybe that's friends. I think that understanding that addiction is a rocky road and everything is not going to necessarily be smooth sailing is really important as you're kind of helping that person go through. I also think there's kind of that other side of it that is really, really difficult for family members. And as you are, you know, just watching people go down in flames and trying to offer that support, you know, again, it kind of gets back to what we talked about a little bit ago is, you know, there is no magic motivation. Like, I don't have a medication that can motivate somebody to be sober. There is no one thing that you can say to somebody. So I think just kind of at some point you have to keep supporting that family member and hopefully they are ready to stop using, to stop their substance, to start getting better. But honestly, it's kind of that matter of the patient has to be the one in control and the patient has to be the one deciding to get better.
I can't tell you how many times I said, I'm done. Probably 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And I would quit for 3-4 months. But in the back of my mind, I think I always knew, oh, well, Floyd, you're going to drink again. We just need to calm everybody down because of what you did was so bad. Now they're all worked up. So let them get calmed down. Let them forget about it. And then I'd go right back to it. And we'd get there again. And I'd quit again. It wasn't until I had lost virtually everything that I made the decision, this time's for real. And you're right. There's nothing anyone could have said. There's nothing anyone could have done. Because as long as that little guy was in the back of my head saying, we'll just calm him down and we'll go right back to our same cycles, our same habits, I knew I was going to return to it. Mm-hmm. How important is hope in your line of work?
I think that's probably the most important thing that people have is hope. Especially because, I mean, just like you alluded to, you know, addiction, even as we're going through treatment, even as people really commit to getting better, tends to be a relapsing, remitting course, meaning that, you know, people are probably going to relapse after they get sober, after they get clean. And we always start, we tell people that's kind of the rule, not the exception here. Hopefully, as we go along, those returns to use, those relapses become less frequent, they become shorter, they become less impactful, and they kind of taper off and eventually disappear. And I always stress that with my patients, you know, because at some point there's still that same stigma that creeps in. Is they're really hopeful, they want to get treatment, they come in, they're doing great, and then they have a relapse, and it's hard because they feel embarrassed to come back into clinic. And I really stress, you know, over and over, you know, it would be awesome if everybody that walked through that door never used anything again, but that's not the nature of this. You know, we try to pick up the pieces, we try to figure out where we went sideways, and just get back on track. And for patients that are really committed to it, they do really, really well, but it has to be kind of that understanding that for most people, it's not going to be smooth sailing.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I would love everyone out there to understand. A relapse is not a failure. And we're going to go through these. So accept that that's going to happen. And it's not an excuse to relapse.
Correct.
It is not an excuse to relapse. But if it does happen, your team is still here. Everyone is still with you. Now, before I run out of time with you, one thing that you and I touched on last year, and I want to touch on again, medications.
Yes.
You spoke on it a little bit, but there's also the stigma out there that if you're going to sober up or if you're going to hang up any usage, then it's got to be everything. Mm-hmm. People want you to go clean, cold turkey out the gate. But we have medications that can help now. And would you speak on those a little bit for me? Because I don't want people to shy away from these if it's a good path to recovery.
Right. And I think that that's crucial. And again, just our understanding of this as a disease process has come so far. And so, we had mentioned a little bit offline at the beginning, when AA first started, they described alcohol addiction as an allergy.
They had nowhere to go with it.
We couldn't describe it in any other way. And so now understanding the disease process and understanding what receptors in the brain are affected by different substances and where those cravings are coming from, we have really good medications that can help reduce cravings. We have medications that can block opioid receptors that keep people from having cravings for opioids. But we have similar medications that will keep people from having cravings for alcohol. And so they can work their way through this. I always tell people, there's a difference between sobriety and recovery. And those medications can really help us achieve sobriety, and they can really help us abstain from those substances and or at least cut down our use. That recovery is kind of like that whole person thing, though. Like, you really need to have the relationships, and that's really the why you're trying to do this. Yeah. Like, what is your why for this? And I think one thing that everybody that's going through recovery will tell you, though, is they can't get to that point without sobriety. And so really these medications are helping us get traction. They're helping us to really be able to put the substance down and to be able to do it without thinking about it 24/7. Because I think when you're actually trying to get sober, there's a huge difference between white knuckling it and thinking about it constantly and just trying to get from 1 second to the next. There's a huge difference from that to actually having medications on board that can reduce those cravings, that can allow you to start building those relationships and to start doing those things that you really like to do. And so it's really that, like, this is how we develop the whole person again. This is how we reinvent ourselves and get to that new person.
And it's such a long road, but you're right. If we could expand our toolbox a little bit and say, okay, well, I can take this medication under the guidance of a medical professional. My doctor, my addictions doctor, says I can take this and start to focus more on rebuilding my relationships, developing that support group. The road to recovery could be quicker, I guess I could say, mm-hmm. and a little easier. Mm-hmm. Now, before I run out of time with you, let's take a look at the new developments happening out at Sheridan Memorial Hospital. Mm-hmm. I got 5 minutes left. How is your office going to work with behavioral health? Because the two could mesh very, very easily and usually do.
Yeah. And I think there's a huge overlap in terms of our patients. And I think, we're really excited to have Dr. Kinney here, our new psychiatrist. I think that's going to be a huge win. I think really focusing on the behavioral health component is we've needed this for a really long time to really be able to address that. I think one of the things that's always really important to just remember is this isn't a whole new subset of patients. Like, these patients exist in Sheridan. Like, this is a need as it is. And a lot of those patients we're already seeing in our addiction clinic. And so as we kind of start partnering with the behavioral health and kind of integrating, with behavioral health, it's really just expanding access to all of these things that help people get better. And so I think what's really exciting about it is, we're just, again, we're expanding our tools, we're getting more resources for people. And, a lot of people really going through crisis are struggling with substance use, and a lot of people struggling with substance use are really struggling with their mental health. Like, it tends to be the rule, not the exception. So again, I think it's just going to be really, really good for Sheridan to have this degree of access to behavioral health, mental health, addiction services.
Because I, Doc, I'll admit, I was seeing doctors, medical doctors, and I was going to three separate therapists, one was a chaplain, but he's a therapist as well. And my road to recovery was peppered with people who wanted to help me. When I was in the throes of my alcoholism, I had blinders on. I didn't see those people standing off on the side of the road. And if I did, I discarded them because I wasn't ready to take that step. As we go into the holiday season, the tough time for some, festival for others, what would you say to the families of those who were suffering and then ultimately to those who were suffering?
I think getting back to your message from just a few minutes ago, I think hope is really important. And I think there's always hope with that, you know. And I think for some people, they see it, it's a really dark time and they have a hard time reaching out and actually asking for help. And when they do, I think they're amazed that there are so many people that are willing to jump in and help. And I think they are amazed at how much that can really help them, you know, getting in with counseling or starting medications or just, you know, a lot of times we have patients come in and we talk about all of our medication options and they choose not to necessarily start something, but we keep following and we keep tabs and we just kind of offer that support. And so I think that that degree of hope is huge. And just knowing that even if it's, you know, even if that person isn't ready today or tomorrow, like, we'll still be there. And yeah. So like just knowing that there are people that are willing to help and will always be willing to help.
If someone wanted to reach out and start this journey, what do they need to do?
So they can just give us a call. We don't have any sort of referrals needed. 675-2674. We're on the hospital website. I believe there's even an email in there and we can reach out. And so really just any way of kind of getting in touch with us and then we can reach out. Our staff is amazing. We have, Casey McKenzie is a PA that works with me, and we have two addiction certified nurses. Shiloh and Katie both basically run the office, and they've gone on their own and gotten addiction certifications on top of their RNs, and they're just amazing humans. And so we have peer specialists that help. We partner with outpatient BOA. Like there's a big network, again, just a big network of people that are really trying to help.
There is help, folks. And people want to help you. Don't be ashamed. You can overcome this. And I'm a sitting testament to that right now. I thought I was going to die an alcoholic for many, many years. And so I can say that there is such a fantastic life after climbing the hill. And it's there for you as well. Give the doctor a call. Speak with some of his people. Your journey can begin today. Doc, I want to thank you so much for coming in this morning and speaking with me. It is always a pleasure having you on, my friend.
Absolutely. Really appreciate having me on.
Thank you. You've been listening to Public Pulse on 930 KROE and 103.9 FM. Sheridan.